The killing of 18-year-old Andres Guardado in Los Angeles turns the spotlight on police brutality in the Latino community. That's where we start today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 23rd. I'm Tanzina Vega. Also on the show, we sit down with the WNBA's Renee Montgomery, who's sitting out this season to focus on social justice.
There needs to be some cultural education in the schools to where people can understand why people are so angry. I know things that happened to my mom. This is not a 400 years ago thing. This is a now thing. There was just a noose.
Plus, how's your quarantine garden looking these days?
I have planted things like cilantro and parsley and basil.
We check in with how your plants are bringing you joy, and I talk with Ron Finley, the self-proclaimed gangster gardener, about how he's trying to spread the love to places that might not have much green space.
I just wanted to beautify my neighborhood. I wanted people to walk out and be assaulted by lavender and beautiful flowers and bees and dragonflies and butterflies on your shoulder. And all it is us putting it there.
But first, in Los Angeles on Sunday, a crowd of hundreds marched to the Compton Sheriff's Station to demand justice for Andres Guardado. Guardado, who was 18 years old, was shot and killed last Thursday by a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy. According to the Sheriff's Department, Guardado ran when two sheriff deputies pulled up near the auto body shop where he worked as a security guard. According to police, the deputies chased Guardado, and one of the deputies shot him 6 times in the upper torso during the pursuit. The Sheriff's Department also claims that Guardado was carrying a gun, but has not said whether he pointed it at the deputies. Protesters claim, however, that Guardado was shot in the back. Guardado's killing is just the latest high-profile incident of police brutality against Latinos. According to research by the Washington Post, from 2015 to 2020, Hispanic Americans were the second highest demographic killed by police after Black Americans. Understanding how police violence against Latinos fits into the nationwide uprising against police brutality is where we start today. Joining me now to discuss is Memo Torres, a reporter and director of partnerships for LA Taco, an outlet covering culture and community in Los Angeles. Memo, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Eddie Portillos, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. Eddie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Memo, let's start with you. You guys have been on the ground covering this, these protests. You spoke with the shop manager at the auto body shop where Guardado worked, who said he witnessed the killing. What is his account? How does his account compare to what we're hearing from police?
There are strong similarities to the account. Of course, the versions are different from the point of view. You know, there's still a lot that we don't know, but the facts that stay true are that both accounts state that police saw Guardado in the front. He says that Guardado was in the front talking to a couple girls, at which point when the police came, Guardado ran scared into the down the long driveway of the auto body shop, at which point the police pursued him. The body shop owner claims in the interview that Guardado ran to the end of the driveway towards the end of the building, and at which point he gave up and surrendered. He states that he got on his knees and put his hands behind his back and was then shot. He said 7 times, the police said 6 times. The police didn't say in which position Guardado was in, but that he was shot in the torso at least 6 times.
Memo, so far we have not, unlike many of the other high-profile shootings of Black Americans in particular, here we don't have, or I don't know whether or not we have this on video. Is there any body camera footage or any other video that substantiates some of these claims?
There is no body camera footage. In fact, that was been one of Sheriff Alex Villanueva's campaign promises and one of the first things he requested when he took control of the Sheriff's Department. It's been about a year and a half now since then, and he's put most of that blame on the city and the county Board of Supervisors. And interesting enough, yesterday he got into a little tweet fight with one of the supervisors, Mark Riley Thomas, about that.
Eddie, you have been studying interactions between the police and Latino communities for years now. How does the story right now that we're hearing about Andres Guardado, how does his case compare to other high-profile killings? We understand, we just did a segment the other week on Sean Monterosa. For those who remember New York City back in the 80s, Anthony Baez was one of the other high-profile cases. When you look at these cases, what is there a connecting thread?
You know, first of all, I want to express my condolences to the family. You know, it's another sad event in the community. And sadly, these are not unusual. You know, there's a long history of state-sanctioned violence in Latinx communities. I'm going back to the Texas Rangers and in the Southwest, the Zoot Suit Riots, and, you know, all the efforts that were made to control Mexican labor in the Southwest through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. So these are not unusual. We think about Julio Valerio as another kind of similar incident in the late 1990s. A young man, his family called the police for assistance, and he was carrying a knife, and they just wanted help, right? And the police end up shooting him multiple times in Phoenix, Arizona. And so, you know, the common thread here is this idea, or it happens in communities where Latinos are considered dangerous and criminal. And so as a result, sometimes these shootings happen.
Memo, you were at a demonstration on Sunday in response to the killing of Andres Guardado. What were the interactions that you witnessed between law enforcement and protesters, which, as we're seeing across the country with the sort of racial justice uprising, can often be tense? Was that what you saw with these protests?
Yeah, tensions were really high once we got to the sheriff's station. You know, the march started, it was 3.5 mile march from the site of the shooting to the Compton Sheriff's Department. It was peaceful all the way through, but once the march got in to the Sheriff's Department and found the barricade with about a dozen sheriffs in riot gear, it got pretty tense. I think you played it in the intro, the loud shouting of "show us the tapes, show us the tapes." They were in their faces, and one of the sheriffs kept pointing one of his weapons, like a shotgun, probably one of the rubber bullet shotguns, at protesters. And there was a lot of yelling, and you could feel the energy there.
Eddie, you mentioned historical context here about the Zoot Suit Riots, the Texas Rangers, the sort of targeting, historical targeting of Latinos by law enforcement. Let's talk up a little bit about how immigration enforcement plays into this and police departments who are collaborating with ICE and other federal agencies. How does that affect the relationship between police and Latino communities? Of course, with the understanding that not all Latinos are immigrants, but it does represent a substantive percentage of the community.
Yeah, it certainly increases the fear that immigrants have of the police when you feel like you can't call them for assistance, or that if you do call them for assistance, then you can be deported. And within my own research that I've done in Arizona, you know, one of the interesting aspects of doing research within the Latinx community is that there's not one set view of the police. And these views change over time. For example, when immigrants first arrived from Mexico, they initially tend to view the police in very positive ways because they're comparing what they're seeing here in the United States with the very bad policing that's in Mexico, where you can literally pay the police officers off there. So when they initially arrive, they have very positive views. But then after a couple of years of being in the United States, they begin to see the ways in which the police operate, that they're not really truly there to help them. And so when you don't feel like you can call the police for help, that increases levels of fear in those communities.
And you've also, Eddie, you've also done research within the police departments themselves. What have you found in terms of how police departments, at least those that you've researched, generally view the communities that they are policing, if those communities happen to be Latino. And of course, we're going to also talk about this big word Latino and what that really means. But in terms of how police departments view these communities more broadly, how what would you say you found in your research?
So I did research in Arizona with the Phoenix Police Department and was able to do ride-alongs with them. And, you know, most of the police officers, they really talk about wanting to help the community, how they don't see race and how they want to be helpful. But the way in which they describe the community is not, doesn't fit those sentiments. They talked about a community that was very dangerous. The exception was the Latino officers. Latino police officers talked about the communities in which they grew up differently. But those who worked in the community talked about it as a war zone, as a dangerous place, as a place that you want to avoid, as a place where they wouldn't take their own families. And so they were very fearful of the people in those communities.
Memo, do we know anything about the officers who were involved in Guardado's killing? Because one of the things that we're seeing with the broader protests and uprising for racial justice in the United States is also protesters knowing who committed the acts that they're referring to and asking for accountability for those officers in particular. So what do we know so far about the officers themselves, if anything?
The ones involved specifically with Andres Guardado?
Yes.
We don't know anything yet. I've been searching for reports. There's nothing confirmed. They haven't named an officer yet. We don't know who exactly that was.
And Eddie, when we think about, we mentioned at the top that Hispanic Americans or Latinos or Latinx communities are the second largest targets for police brutality here. But what does the data tell us about the rate of police shootings and the use of force within Latino communities?
We know that it's disproportional. And what that means is that in comparison to their percentage in the population, it tends to be a little bit higher than what it should be. And so, you know, that's, again, that's scary for the Latinx community when you don't feel like the police are there to help you.
I was going to say, I was going to piggyback on that, that in LA, I can give you specific statistics about that.
Please do.
I mean, since 2000, we've had about 900 victims reported deaths at the hands of the police, and about 80% of those were Black or Latino. And those, of all the deaths, 998% of them were all shooting deaths. And since the year 2000, only two officers have been criminally charged. So we do have a high propensity, a way higher propensity of dying at the hands of police if you're Black or Latino than if you're white.
And Memo, we're going to unpack a little bit more about what Latino means, because it means so many different things. But the community in LA is also very diverse among Latinos. What's the response been to the police killing of Guardado so far? Are we seeing what we're seeing across the country, which is really a sort of multiracial, multiethnic protesters? Or are we seeing largely Latinos coming out? What are we seeing?
Yeah, we are. The most of the protests have been very diverse. The one thing that we've noticed, you know, that on the internet people will always fight. There's always trolls, but when you're out on the streets, you see a strong unity from Mexicans, Salvadorians, and Guatemalans, and other Latinos showed up to support Andres Guardado march. The Black community came through as well and provided escort and security for the march. White folks came through, and to me, it was an incredible display of diversity and unity amongst the different races that I had never seen before for most protests in LA.
Was there diversity among, you mentioned that at Sunday's protest, you saw a lot of the police officers who you think may have been Latino. Did that affect anything?
Yeah. I mean, half the LAPD and the sheriffs are Latino here in Los Angeles, about 45% roughly. And at the Compton Sheriff Station, almost every single person that we saw there was a brown-faced Latino. And the crowd didn't let that go unnoticed. They chanted at them about that. It's something that's very upsetting in the Latino community that their own Latinos are the ones doing this to themselves in the community of Compton specifically.
Eddie, we hear a lot that diversifying police forces around the country will improve the treatment of people of color. When it comes to, this has been a big conversation among Black officers, I'm wondering what you think as it relates to Latino officers.
I mean, that's certainly something that we've seen since the Civil Rights Movement, this push that we need to have more equity in terms of hiring and bringing officers of color into the police force. But, you know, that doesn't always seem to make a difference, right? Because we know that use of force has been proportional by ethnic groups, right? So we know, for example, if a police department is made up of 17% Latino officers, use of force is about 17% as well. So we don't see huge decreases, but we don't see increases as well in terms of the use of force. And again, what really seems to matter is if you're able to hire, at least with my own research, I talked earlier about how officers in the community talked about police as, or the communities as a war. This is a dangerous place, right? Latin officers, Latino officers did not have those perceptions. This was their communities. This is where they grew up. This was where their families were raised. And so that certainly seems to be more important. If you can bring in officers who were a part of that community or who feel like they are a part of the community, that seems to make a huge difference.
Memo, I'm wondering, you know, we talked a little bit about the diversity here. Is this case bringing more Latinos out to in solidarity with the movement against police brutality?
Oh, it's yet to be seen. I did see a lot of it was mostly Latino at the march. You know, I've been to all the BLM protests throughout the week since they've started, and there have been large groups of Latinos in the crowds, but it's hard to tell how much of the Latinos it is because they've been so diverse in those crowds. But I am seeing a lot of Latinos out there. It's hard to say proportionally wise, numbers wise, how many in the crowds there were.
One of the reasons why it's such a complicated question, Memo and Eddie, and I'm sure we all are aware of this being Latinos ourselves, is the diversity within our own community, not just in terms of national and ethnic origin, but also racial diversity. I want to talk a little bit about the question of race and data, Eddie, because there's long been a conversation about, A, the lack of data that is collected about these killings and use of force by police officers. But when the data is collected, we know that Latinos can be of many races. Are we often miscategorized in this data?
We certainly are. I mean, you know, historically, that's been the case of where Latinos were counted as whites. And so it's a confusion about whether we're a race or we're an ethnicity. And some police departments will categorize Latinx as a race, and some will categorize them as an ethnicity. And so, and when you look at federal data as well, you don't have an accurate count, right? We have data that comes from the federal government regarding the use of force, which doesn't seem to match what we're seeing, for example, with the Washington Post. Completely two different numbers. And part of that is how we categorize race and ethnicity.
And is it just a general lack of understanding about the fact that someone can be Black and Latino? They can be white and Latino. They can be indigenous and Latino.
Yeah, there's confusion about that intersectionality. We want to see people in one category or the other, and we fail to recognize that people can fit into multiple categories. They may have multiple races or ethnicities in terms of how they identify themselves.
Memo, this is something that we here on the show are going to be unpacking a little bit more later in the week. But just in terms of that, going off of that point, are you noticing more presence, if you will, or people who are identifying as Afro-Latino or Black and Latino at this weekend's demonstration and sort of beginning to connect the dots for both of our communities?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, you know, just looking at them, if there were Afro-Latinos, you know, it's hard visually to know. I didn't have personal conversations, you know, but that is a discussion that's been carried out, at least in LA, of, you know, the negligence of people to recognize that there are, you know, Black Latinos. and how they fit into this conversation, you know, especially when, you know, when people say Black Lives Matter or Brown Lives Matter, where do they fall in, you know, it's been a very conflicting issue for that population.
We're going to be unpacking a lot more of that issue later this week. Memo Torres is a reporter and director of partnerships for LA Taco, and Eddie Portillos is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Colorado. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, we looked at sports and activism in this moment as many leagues reverse their former stances against protesting for racial justice. And today we turn to one athlete who's decided to step off the court to do just that.
Montgomery off the bounce. Three is good and the foul. And Renee Montgomery will go to the line for a chance at a four-point play.
At the other end, Montgomery at the buzzer. Yes! The three!
Renee Montgomery is a WNBA guard for the Atlanta Dream, and she recently opted out of playing in the 2020 WNBA season to focus on her fight for racial justice and equality. Renee, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
So that was some exciting sound that we heard. Basketball is nothing short of fast moving and thrilling. You're leaving it right now. What was the catalyst that forced you to feel like it was now the time?
I think it was a string of events. I mean, I think the whole world had an awakening when George Floyd was murdered. So that obviously triggered me. And then just talking to my mom about the stuff that she went through. You know, she went through a lot of things that I didn't even know about. You know, I didn't even start asking the questions until the George Floyd murder. So then when I found out the history that like my own parents went through, I would say that solidified that, okay, I'm not going to play and I'm going to figure, like, let's try to figure this thing out.
And when you're talking about the history that your own parents went through, your parents are?
So my mom is Berlia Montgomery, and she actually grew up in Detroit. So she was in Detroit during the Detroit riots. So when I called her the first night of the Atlanta riots, it was right, you know, around my place. And I told her, like, this is crazy. The people are rioting. And she's like, yeah, I lived through it, too. And it was almost like a sad moment because this is a generational problem. Like, she lived through it. Now, fast forward, here I am in 2020 living through it in Atlanta.
And you said when you were talking to your mom about everything that was going on, you said that your mom said that protesting is what people do when they don't feel heard.
Correct.
Why did that strike you?
Because that's what I have a platform. A lot of people hear everything I say. If I want people to hear what I say, I can just say it and people will hear it. Some people feel like they could scream at the top of their lungs and no one would hear them. And that's the unheard. That's when you start lashing out. If people aren't listening, you start lashing out. So that's why they say protests are the voice of the unheard, because that's the only way that the people can feel heard and feel felt. And so when she was telling me that and basically educating me, I started to get it, which is what kind of prompted me to go out to the protest.
We just opened the segment by talking about how suddenly a lot of sports leagues, you know, the NFL among them, surprisingly, have sort of suddenly decided that they're standing up for Black lives. They're accepting racial justice protests. You're a professional athlete. What do you think when you see all of these leagues that are suddenly making these changes right now? Are you encouraged by that?
Very encouraged, because, you know, even, you know, a lot of people are like, the NFL, there's no way they changed their mind. Well, even if the NFL didn't change their stance or their mind, the fact that they felt enough positive peer pressure that they had to say that, they feel that they have to accept people, that's a win. That's a big deal that the NFL, we know how strong the NFL stance is. So for them to even publicly say things that they're saying, that's a big deal, because they understand that this is the way America's going and they better get on board.
Renee, this isn't the first time that you used your platform as an athlete. After Eric Garner was killed here in New York by police officers, you and there were other players in the WNBA wore short shirts that said, quote, "I can't breathe" in protests. Back then, the league didn't approve of the protests and even fined some folks. We remember also folks like LeBron James and other athletes were wearing T-shirts, and he was criticized for that. So what do you think makes this time different?
I think when Black people were protesting before, it was Black people protesting for Black people's rights. That's why Black Lives Matter is the saying Black Lives Matter. In 2016, when we did that with Minnesota, people were really upset. They didn't understand that Black Lives Matter is not going against the police. It's not going against America. It's not going against the military. We have family in the military too. You know, that's what we were trying to teach people in 2016. So now fast forward to 2020, you see businesses, Black Lives Matter on it. You see the NFL, you see NASCAR banning the Confederate flag. You see a lot of different things that are organizational. It's not just a protest. You see the chokehold getting removed, you know? So I think that for me, that's what makes it different. It's not just people protesting. There are things happening. And so that's why I want to keep the movement going. Right now, people are ready to listen. People are making changes. That might not be the case forever. We know it's not going to be the case forever. So while this is the case, that's why I'm stepping aside, because I want to keep this catalyst, keep this going.
You know, and I think as much progress as has already been made, I think about Bubba Wallace this week finding a noose in his garage. NASCAR just recently, you know, said that they would no longer accept Confederate flag imagery. And then that happened. So are you encouraged, despite these things happening, that there's still something positive to look forward to? I mean, can we really have faith that this is going to make change in the sports community at the very least?
We can. And when I see that the news has a publicity stunt, you know, that's literally a publicity stunt. But for me, that means that somebody's nervous. They feel like their NASCAR is changing, and they want people to know that we're still, you know, that the old fans are still here. You know, we saw a NASCAR driver literally retire because of the announcement that NASCAR was no longer having the Confederate flag be a part of their events. That it was ingrained in their culture. That people are lashing out because they feel like the old NASCAR is leaving. It is. Hi, new NASCAR. Like, it is.
And tell us what you're planning on doing with this time. I mean, you have a foundation, don't you?
Yeah, I have my own foundation. And because my mom has been in the education system for 30 years, she was a professor at West Virginia State University. I think education is going to be my thing. Me being a point guard as well, communication is one of my strong suits. So I think that we're going to start an education reform. I feel like our history books, they're a little bit not in chronological order. We have Black History Month in February, where they tell you everything Black, and then the rest of the year you go in chronological order. Why not put Black history in chronological order? Tulsa, the Tulsa Massacre, Juneteenth. Why wouldn't that just be where it belongs in the history books, not just an excerpt? And people don't even know about those two things, by the way, because I was on with a NASCAR podcast yesterday, and a couple of the guys were shocked to hear that so many people were killed in Tulsa. And I'm like, yeah, we know that. We learned that in the home. But it needs to be learned in the school. There needs to be some cultural education in the schools to where people can understand why people are so angry. Because a lot of white people are like, this happened 4 years ago. Why are you? No, I know things that happened to my mom. This is not a 400 years ago thing. This is a now thing. There was just a noose.
Mm-hmm. Renee, we've been talking on the show about little ways to find joy in this moment that's so hard. We've got about 30 seconds. You know what that means in real time. Is there one thing that you're doing to find joy?
Oh, I'm going to the protest. People are not taking my water because they'll be like, hey, there's an older group over there that needs some water. So I'm finding joy in the newfound humanity outside. Like, people are actually caring for one another, looking out for one another. So there's plenty of joy to be found there.
Renee Montgomery is a WNBA guard for the Atlanta Dream. Renee, it's been a pleasure. Best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met and telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Unequal access to food in the United States is not a new issue, and the coronavirus pandemic is only deepening food insecurity in certain communities. And people of color are more likely to live in food deserts or areas with little access to healthy food. But this guy is trying to change that.
I'm Ron Finley, the gangster gardener.
Ron is from South Central LA, and he started his first garden on a strip of public land between the sidewalk and the road. And since then, he's started dozens more. And today he has a masterclass teaching gardening, and he's determined to help educate everyone, especially those in low-income communities, about the power of gardening your own plants and food. And with gardening seeming to see an uptick during the pandemic, we thought it was a good time to check in. Ron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzino. I'm pretty honored to be here.
I'm pretty honored to have you here because, as we were just talking about, I grew up around cement and bricks and very little access to plants and trees and greenery. And so the importance of that, particularly in low-income communities, is something that you do a lot of work on. What started you down that path?
Beauty started me down that path. I'm a designer, and my whole philosophy is design the life you want to live and not the one that's been designed for you. Those public housings, that was a life designed for us. They knew exactly what our mentality was going to be. They knew exactly what the outcome would be. Living like that, living in these places that look like places of confinement with no green spaces, they know what beauty does for you. So I'm going to change that. I'm going to make my food prison into a food forest. That's what really got me. I just wanted to beautify my neighborhood. I wanted people to walk out and be assaulted by lavender and beautiful flowers and bees and dragonflies and butterflies on your shoulders. And all it is us putting it there. You know, they talk about these underserved communities, and I'll talk to these politicians. Why are underserved communities underserved? And they start with this soliloquy. Oh, you know, it starts with, and it's a long, I said, no, it's real simple. You don't serve them. That's why they're underserved. That's the only reason.
I watched your TED Talk and you referred to gardening in particular as healing and restorative in a lot of ways. And I feel like when you're deprived that experience, when you're deprived, as many people who grow up in low-income communities are deprived of the sensory experiences of gardening, the beauty, the oxygen, the flora and fauna that come with that. But you're also talking about sustenance. And that's a different kind of deprivation, right?
Yes. I'm talking about freedom, Tanzania. That's what I'm talking about, is freedom before everything. Gardens equal freedom to me. And then humanity. That's where it is. It's, to me, it ain't even about the food per se. It's about the process. It's about the process. Because once you become a gardener, you start looking at life a total different way. Everything. Once you make compost, your life changes because you realize nothing ever dies.
But Ron, there are people who would say, okay, that sounds great. I'm down with it. But I live in a tiny apartment that has no soil. Like, what do you want me to do, Ron?
Any kind of box. You can get a wooden shoe box. You can get a plastic container, which I don't like plastic. The bottom line, there's something around you. So you can find things on the street. You can get a tin can. You can get, if it can hold soil, put some in it and put some life in it. Grow life.
Why is that so important, Ron? Because you say gardening is also a form of protest and a form of rebellion.
No, my garden is my revolution. My garden is my evolution. I'm an evolutionary, and because of this garden, I mean, this is my revolution. Because think about it, in our communities, we don't have any kind of healthy food. So am I going to wait for you to put it there, or am I going to do it myself? And that's the lesson: do for self, do for your community. And just imagine if we did this together, if we did this collectively.
How important is gardening, especially at a time like this, for people who are new to it or people who do have more space? How important is it just for moments like this? Because it's been one of the few joys that I have been able to capture in this moment.
Real simple. You can't eat diamonds. And this has gotten people back to what's important. And I know this because I see how many people have watched my masterclass. And it's sometimes you read these letters and these emails that, and it almost brings tears to your eyes, how, you know, people are thanking you for letting them find this and letting them get back to this. I have a relationship with my mom now because we didn't. And now we're gardening together and my kids never eat any vegetables. And now they're eating the vegetables and he wants to water it every day. I mean, this is not, oh, some ladies that lunch or man to lunch. This is a life skill. This is a survival skill. And now we're seeing it because do you want to be waiting in line to hope that there's food left? Or do you want to walk outside your door in your front yard, your side yard, your backyard, or in my case, my swimming pool, and eat for several months and never leave your house? It's a survival skill, but it's a life skill. You need to know how to cultivate food. You need to know how to cook food. And once you know these kind of things, no one can take that away from you. That it's priceless. That has a value beyond money.
Do you think, Ron, that that message is being communicated more and more to Black and brown communities? And I'm asking you because I had an interview months ago with Killer Mike about some other stuff. And one of the things he brought up was being able to grow your own food as a survival tactic for these times. And that was pre-coronavirus. So are young Black and brown kids getting this message?
They are. They are not to the numbers that I want it to be. But again, T, what we have to do is change the value. And that's what has to happen. We have to take the value out of all this silly stuff that they have us buying and purchasing. And if you have this, this means you have value and you're cool. And that's where the whole gangster came from in the gangster gardener. No, soil is gangster. These beets I got over here, they gangster. And air, you can't get no more gangster than air. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, let's flip the script on what truly has value. And it's not these things that these corporations are putting out for us. You know, we have social capital and no one teaches a kid that. And when I talk to these elementary schools, universities, did anybody ever tell you about, you know, that you have a capital, that you have a value, that you are the most precious thing on this planet, that you are the most worthy, the most beautiful thing on this planet with nothing, you. But we have to see that. We have to instill that into our kids. It has to be instilled into us that we know that we have value. And that's why we're going around talking, we matter. I know I matter. So how do we get these kids to realize that they matter and that kid next to you, that he matters? And that's going to be the change. We have to change culture. And that's what the Ron Finley Project, that's my nonprofit. That's what we're doing. That's what this whole mission of. And we've affected people all over the world. I mean, I got kids in India calling themselves gangster gardeners. Like, my work's done. I don't have to do it. If I got kids in India that understand what I'm doing, I'm good. So yeah.
I will say, Ron, I got to ask you what you're planting now. What's the latest in the garden?
Oh my God. Well, how long? How much time you got?
We got, okay, you gotta give me one thing.
More tomatoes.
The season? It's June. So what should people be thinking of planting, including myself right now? What's a good food plant to plant?
A lot of, you know, they can plant some, the thing about it, if you find the right seeds, there's varieties on every, you can get carrots right now. You can get beets right now if you get the right varieties. And that's another thing that happened with the food system is how much food has been taken out of the system, where you have 1,000 different kinds of apples, where you have hundreds of different kinds of carrots, different colors. I mean, I had a dinner here that I used to do, and a woman, we had the purple carrots, and she says, "What is this? The carrots?" And she never seen purple carrots before. She's in her 50s. People don't know the food because they've taken a lot of our food out of the equation, and therefore they've taken a lot of our nutrients out of their equation.
I'll just say this to what you just said. I grew up eating those terrible tomatoes, the ones that don't taste like anything really. And then when I was an adult, I finally had an organic tomato and changed my life.
Is that crazy though? Is that, no.
You just realize you've never tasted something like that.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's like, I never realized I was in love, you know? It's almost like that. This is how this is supposed to taste.
Right.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, it's real. But no, we have to get loyal to the soil. And if you grow it, you know it. You know, we have to look at soil in our culture a total different way. Soil equals life. The thing with health, people eat healthy this, eat healthy. Your environment also affects your health. And nobody really, really talks about that. You know, if you just imagine if you've seen despair and violence and things like that in your city every day, but then you all of a sudden you see beauty, you smell beauty, you see this, you have a tree canopy over your block, that's going to affect your health. And the powers that be know that.
Ron Finley is a community activist and a self-proclaimed gangster gardener, and he also has a new masterclass out teaching gardening. Ron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, my dear, for having me.
You've been telling us about your garden and what it means for you during these times.
Hi, this is Mary McClellan from Huntington, West Virginia. I have flower gardens that I have enjoyed over the years, but this year particularly so, because it gives me hope, because with new growth, there is new beginning. And seeing all this beautiful flowers and the trees and everything else around me makes me feel better.
This is Kevin from Davie. I started a garden just about the beginning of quarantine, and I have to say that it definitely helps. It has helped me a lot, you know, just past time. And it just feels really rewarding every day seeing the garden get a little bit bigger.
This is Beckett from Fort Worth, Texas. I started gardening during the COVID-19 pandemic because it seemed like a somewhat obtainable hobby that I could keep up after the world returns to normal. I have a two-year-old, so I couldn't pick a hobby that required too much attention. I purchased 3 plants and told myself that if I could keep these alive for longer than 3 months, then I could get more. They add a colorful cheer to my patio, and it is somewhat therapeutic to look after them. But I'm only 3 weeks in, so fingers crossed that these guys can make it through the summer and I can step up my gardening game.
I've spent a lot of time in the yard, in the garden, since lockdown started, and it's amazing how therapeutic pulling weeds can be. Put on your headphones and kind of zone out. And, you know, even if you just do it for like 20 minutes or 10 minutes, it's very centering. I can't even believe I'm using words like that. But it really does make me feel better after I go yank some weeds for 10 minutes. I mean, honestly, I never thought that kind of grunt work out in the yard would be so therapeutic. And it is. And I know it is because I feel better afterwards.
And beyond just relaxation, some of you also told us that you've been gardening to help put food on the table and avoid trips to the market.
Yes, I've been gardening during the pandemic with all the time at home. It's just been one of the more affordable options out there for food.
Hi, this is Vinca from San Diego, California. I did take a minor form of gardening for myself. I have planter boxes on my 2 balconies, and I have planted things like cilantro and parsley and basil and thyme, as well as sage. And now that I am shopping less, I'm trying to avoid shopping more than once every 2 weeks. I want to have all these herbs available for my cooking at home, which has also increased in frequency. And it gives me great comfort to be able to just cut a snippet off here and there and still have more to come, so I don't have to be replenishing these items at the grocery store.
8778 My Take. Keep calling. There's more of your gardens up at thetakeaway.org, so go check it out, and happy planting. And that's our show for today. Thanks as always for tuning in. We really appreciate you listening and joining in with your own takeaways, so please give us a call about anything at 8778 My Take or tweet us at The Takeaway. And if you want more information on these stories, you can always find us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram for some behind-the-scenes action. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.